This evening, I want to explore together with the group a theme which I mentioned when I was last with Marin Sangha, which I think was in April. And we chose not to focus on that theme now, but I want to focus tonight on the theme of bringing our practice to the current difficult times. Bringing our practice to the current difficult times. And I'll talk about this, but I also really am holding the evening as collaborative in many ways. I'll want to give a good period of time for our discussion. So I think I'll start with a cartoon, which expresses one perspective on bringing our practice to difficult times. This is a cartoon about the guru happy hour. One guru says to another, "Anytime someone asks for wisdom in politics, I just say, it is what it is, and then change the subject." That's the voice from Enlightenment Lounge, as we can see. So we can let go of the image. So I'll have a little different perspective than comes from the Guru Happy Hour. And I really want to talk more generally about our practice. And particularly recall that our practice is framed in terms of three dimensions. And Pali sometimes talked about as sila, samadhi, and panya, translated usually in the order in a little different order, wisdom, meditation, and ethics. And we could really look to each of those dimensions as really crucial for bringing our practice to the current times. It's very similar threefold distinction to what we find in Tibetan tradition. In Tibetan tradition, we find the distinction very similar between view, meditation, and conduct. So what I'd like to do is to point to really how each of these dimensions of practice are crucial. And I'll give a framework in which I'm really understanding our practice as involved, particularly through the dimension of ethics, as integrating inner transformation and outer transformation. Sometimes we have a sense of our practice that is just about inner transformation. And that's very common. And sometimes we even have a sense that, the world outside is hopeless. It's samsara, and samsara will never change. And we focus on inner awakening. That's sometimes an understanding of practice. Does anyone sometimes have that yourself, something like that? I just focus on the inner dimension. I think that's not actually accurate to what the understanding was historically. And what I want to suggest is that the grounding in ethics is really crucial. What we call, what's translated as ethics, is really crucial for our times. It's also a dimension of practice which is often neglected in the West. I don't think it's neglected in the Asian context, but in the Western development of Buddhism, the ethical dimension is often really on the sidelines. So I want to give a special focus to that as important in our times. And then also bring in some the importance of meditating, particularly with our our difficult emotions, where we're stuck, where there's numbness, difficult emotions, difficult thoughts, maybe a more obvious way to bring our practice to the current difficult times. And then I also want to point to the importance of connecting with joy in difficult times. And some of you may have gone to the No Kings gathering. Yeah, I don't know whether they had those in Canada, Carolyn. Maybe a little bit, but there was a possibility of joy coming out of that. And the importance of connecting with joy. And then also, I want to talk about listening for what really calls one. And in all of this, I want to have plenty of room for different views. In fact, I think that maybe right at the center of what's needed, really a dimension of wise speech, which is a part of ethics. What is most needed in our time is empathic listening and understanding across divisions. That is probably most crucial now. So I want also to have us manifest that here and welcome all views, whatever they are related to the current times. Remembering that we can have empathy, which means tuning in to what matters for the other and what the emotions are. We can have empathy without agreement. I can be empathic towards another person, but not necessarily agree. Really, really crucial point. And then also listening for, again, I want to point to the importance of listening for what really calls one in these times. So I want to suggest that our practice is designed for all the parts of our lives. And again, sometimes the way Western Buddhism has been interpreted, we miss that. That it becomes much more of an inner practice, that the emphasis is on meditation. Sometimes even weekly groups are called meditation groups. And there's a strong pressure to focus on meditation. I was one of the people involved in the founding of the East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland. And originally, our name for it was the East Bay Dharma Center, because we wanted to avoid having that suggestion that meditation is at the center. But for various reasons, particularly because people didn't really understand very widely the notion of Dharma, we reverted and we called it the East Bay Meditation Center. Interesting, isn't it? We did that because we thought that would communicate the best, even though I think it's based on a misunderstanding. It's very interesting. Yeah. And so I think there are understandable reasons why there's been so much a focus on meditation. The contemplative dimension has been largely lost from Western religions for almost 1,000 years, although there are examples of it. I go every year to the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky and stay there for a while, where Thomas Merton was a monk, and I've stayed in touch with people there, and that represents the contemplative Christian tradition. Like Kabbalah in Judaism, until pretty recently, it was very hard to find. I remember one friend who said, I looked 20 years to find a Kabbalah teacher, and I only found it when I traveled to Israel. Right? I couldn't find it in the West. Interesting. And so, again, ethics has been somewhat marginalized, not taught very much, I remember when I was first practicing, I was living in Massachusetts and going to the Insight Meditation Society, and I really got the message that if I was really a sincere practitioner, I would just meditate all the time. Has anyone got that message at times? Something like that? Yeah. And that was hard for me because before I got into meditation in my early 20s, I had been more of an activist, which was also the background of my parents. Many of you met my mom, but my parents at one time marched with Dr. King, were very involved with social issues. My father had been in the military in World War II and was in the reserves, and he wore, during the 60s, he wore anti-war buttons to his active duty with the military. Interesting, right? So that was what I was brought up with. And at a certain point, I wanted that to go together with the meditation. So for quite a long period of time, about 10 or 12 years, I was much more involved with Buddhist Peace Fellowship than with Spirit Rock, because I really wanted to bring the inner and the outer together. And that's been really a vision. And I think it's actually, again, a vision which is true to the vision of Buddhist practice, which is to have practice in all the parts of one's life. And for that, what we call the ethical dimension is so crucial. And, ethics is, I don't know, it's not the greatest translation. This is, one colleague who's a teacher in England. He likes to use the word care as a translation for ethics. Can we bring care and non-harming into the world? And the vision of grounding in caring, in non-harming, in repairing harm is a pillar of our practice. Again, generally neglected in Western practice. Part of my aim this evening is to have us be more interested in it and even take on some deliberate focus on ethical practice in the next week, before we come together again in a week in person. Most of us know the five ethical precepts for lay people. If we were monastics, we would have 200 plus precepts. I wouldn't even be able to read them in the time allotted to me this evening. Right? But most of us know the five ethical precepts, which are basically about not harming oneself, not harming others. And then the positive side of that, we could say, is care. Care and non-harming for oneself and others is a very simple way to talk about our ethical practice. And so we know the precept about not harming others, not killing others, very much related, I think, to a commitment to nonviolence in social action. The second, not taking that which is not given. The third, care with sexuality. Very crucial. The fourth is skillful speech, which is, most of a really important area for me. I've been teaching retreats on wise speech for about 20 years. And it's a crucial area, often underdeveloped in our practice. It can be, if we practice wise speech, we may be having a sense of actual practice much of the day, not just when we sit and meditate. That's the fourth guideline. The fifth guideline is care with what changes consciousness. Yeah. And so what's very interesting is that even when we take ethics seriously, we often interpret the ethical precepts as primarily about our own face-to-face behavior. But that's not really, I think, how the precepts have been generally understood. There's actually a strong social dimension, historically, from the Buddha on, about how to interpret the precepts. This is from the Dhammapada, from the Buddha. Not to do any evil, to cultivate what is wholesome, to purify one's mind and heart. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. And probably many of us know that the Buddha refused to bring the caste system of the society of his time into the monastic community. And he gave very strong critiques of the caste system. If there was social media at that time, he would have been really got a lot of negative posts. But there wasn't. Interestingly, about 250 years after the time of the Buddha, there was a king in what we now call India, some of you know about, called Ashoka, Ashoka. Ashoka, 20, probably what, almost 2,400 years ago, abolished the death penalty. He was a Buddhist practitioner. He abolished the death penalty 2,400 years ago. Are we a little behind? He abolished the death penalty. He provided medical facilities for all human beings and also for non-human animals. 2,400 years ago, medical facility for other animals. Amazing, right? He commissioned officers to work for the welfare and happiness of those who were poor and those who were older. Special help for those populations. He had a plan to end all killing of other animals for the royal kitchen, and he limited the number of animals to be killed for food in a very major way with a plan to end it. One scholar said of Ashoka, he developed a moral society of active social concern, religious tolerance, ecological awareness, the observance of basic ethical precepts, and the renunciation of war 2,400 years ago, based on Ashoka's Buddhist practice. And we find some of that social interpretation of the ethical precepts with the Buddha. You can find the Buddha's explanation, for example, of non-harming. And this is from the Sutta Nipata from the Buddha. Let one not destroy life, nor cause others to destroy life, and also not approve of others' killing. Do you hear the social dimension of the precept? Not just about one's own behavior. You know, this has been brought out more by people like Thich Nhat Hanh. Some of you know he has a set of ethical guidelines. In his, it says, do not kill, do not let others kill. That's his interpretation of Buddhist ethics. Another one from Thich Nhat Hanh, do not avoid contact with suffering or close your eyes before suffering. Do not lose awareness of the existence of suffering in the life of the world. Also from Thich Nhat Hanh, do not live with a vocation that is harmful to humans and nature. I've spent time in Thailand, and some of it I got to know Suluk Sivaraksha, who was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And in his work, there's also a very clear social interpretation of the ethical guidelines. This is what he said. We may not literally steal in our face-to-face interactions, but do we allow the rich countries to exploit the poor countries through the workings of the international banking system and the international economic order? Do we allow industrial societies to exploit agrarian societies, the first world to exploit the third world, the rich to exploit the poor generally? So he's interpreting the ethical precept about stealing in a broad way. And so we can ask, if I want to follow the ethical precepts as part of my practice, how do I do so in a way which also connects with social political realities, which I think, again, is implicit in the teachings that I've given, that if we really want to follow the ethical precepts, that again, I'm stressing that this has not been a central part of most people's practice, but this is really central for bringing our practice into responding to what's going on in the world. So how do we stop harm? What do we do when our tax dollars are causing harm? When our leaders are doing harmful things, I would say that following the ethical precepts and having an ethical practice leads us to asking those questions. Not easy. Really important, actually, to ask the questions in the community, ask them with others. You know, how do we do that? So that's a fundamental area of practice to take seriously. And I want to invite people in the next week, if you feel called in this way, to give attention to ethical practice. You can work with the ethical guidelines, either work with all of them or just choose one or two. You know, let me work with the guideline of wise speech, or let me work with the guideline of non-harming. Remember it every morning, maybe every afternoon, and see how it changes how you act. You know, basically, the ethical guidelines function in at least two ways. They are behavioral guidelines for how we should act, but they also, in a way, are mindfulness guidelines. When I've said something that may be harmful, you know, I may remember, am I really following the ethical guideline? You know, and this can come up all during the day. Earlier in the day, for example, I was driving and returning from going swimming. And I was at a stop sign waiting to go. And there was another stop sign, 90 degrees. And someone came up to the stop sign well after I had come up. And right as I was going to start, just went ahead and went through. And I honked really loudly. And what, self-righteously at the person. Anyone ever done that? No. Okay. And I wondered, you know, even though in a sense I had, you know, I think my perception was accurate that the person was doing something a little bit dangerous. It felt somewhat aggressive. And I, you know, when I do that, sometimes I immediately notice, in this case, I almost immediately did forgiveness practice, both for myself, for what I had done, and for the other, right? So what I want to invite, if you feel called, is to do ethical practice, maybe with one guideline or all of them. It can be a wonderful practice. I once worked with a group where we followed the ethical guidelines as practice for 6 months. We did one guideline a month for 5 months, and then we brought them all together. And again, set the intention for the guidelines in the morning, maybe in the afternoon, take notes, notice what comes up. So a second area I'll be briefer on, it's more familiar, that's really crucial in our times, is doing our own practice with difficult emotions or difficult thoughts, narratives that are in our mind. Very, very crucial in our time. And again, remembering that when difficult emotions or thoughts come up, it's typically helpful to make an assessment of the level of intensity. When it's a 9 or a 10, it may not be appropriate to bring mindfulness to it. When there are very difficult emotions that are a 9 or a 10, the Buddha often recommended Netflix as a way to deal, in other words, bring your attention somewhere else, right? When it's a 9 or a 10. When it's in the workable area, I think really crucial to actually bring up the emotions. You might say, I've been feeling kind of depressed about what's happening. Let me bring that up deliberately in a meditation, maybe at the end of the day, and go into it. It's very easy in these times to numb out. Has anyone felt that tendency to sort of numb out some? It's also possible, of course, to overload on the news. Almost anyone done that? Very, very easy to do. So we want to be careful with those. And we want to, I think, really work, bring up what has come up. Maybe anger or despair, fear. And I think to really touch that emotional pain or the negative narratives that are looping around in one's mind. Sometimes this is helpful and can actually be more skillful to do this in a group setting. So I was thinking, Isabel, there could be groups that come together for working with what's come up. I've been very influenced by working with Joanna Macy, who has a number of practices for being with difficult emotions in a group setting. And it's been really, really important for me, and I use it in my teaching. Quite a bit. If people are interested, we could do some of that next week. But I'll mention one of them. There's a practice called the Truth Mandala. Anyone know that practice? Probably some of you do. And it's a group practice. It's really a group ritual where people gather together in a group, form a circle, and in the center, there are four quadrants which stand for four difficult emotions or mind states. One of them is for fear. One of them is for sadness. One of them is for anger. One of them is for confusion. And in the middle, there's a cushion for anything else that one might be experiencing. And in the ritual, people go into the circle, usually one or two at a time. Go to the quadrant related to the emotion that people are feeling. Be there, feel the emotion, and then they speak to the group about what they're experiencing. I'm feeling really fearful about this. And I remember one time, it was actually when I was working with Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and this was at the time of the first Gulf War. And I'd been doing a lot of work, very, very active. We actually had a Buddhist Peace Fellowship meeting the very evening that the bomb started falling. And after that, I was starting to feel numb. And I think I was actually numb a little bit before that. And it so happened that 3 or 4 days later, I was part of a training with Joanna Macy. We were being trained to lead her work. We did the Truth Mandala that I described with 70 people, all in a circle. People got into the center. I got into the center and I talked about what I was experiencing. I was deeply in touch with anger, with fear, and the numbness went away almost immediately. And I was able to act for the next few months. And so sometimes ritual and groups, rather than just doing it on one's own, are a really crucial way to practice. I don't know if it makes sense to try to do that next week. Is anyone interested in something like that next week? Okay, I see a few people, but not the majority. So, two further themes, and then I want to open things up, and I'll be brief with these. Maintaining joy in the middle of difficulties, really, really crucial. Staying in connection with one's joy, gratitude, appreciation, even when there are hard times. Being connected with the goodness of people, of the earth. I thought of Emma Goldman. Some of you know Emma Goldman, the anarchist from the beginning of the 20th century. She's reported to have said, "If I can't dance, I don't want to be in your revolution." To me, that's about bringing joy into all of this. She actually didn't say that, but she said something somewhat close. And I was thinking of it's really the way that joy, according to the Buddha, is part of our basic nature. Right? And, when I came in April, I talked about having in the month of March practiced the jhanas, the states of concentrative absorption. And the second jhana is getting absorbed in happiness and joy. The teaching is that it's an inherent part of our being. It's always there. All you need to do is tap into it. That's a very interesting teaching. It's always there. We just have to touch it. And I also thought of the way that music and song was so much a part of the civil rights movement. Really so crucial to that. And I thought of also a song related to an old Hasidic teacher named Rabbi Nachman of Breslov from the end of the 18th century. And I thought I would sing it. I don't usually sing during my Dharma talks. You ready for Donald singing? Okay, here goes. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov used to say, "Friends, do not despair. A difficult time has come upon us. Our joy must fill the air. We must not lose our faith in living. We must not despair. A difficult time is upon us. Our joy must fill the air." Thank you. Thank you. So, not Buddhist, but a cousin to Buddha. Okay. So let me just finish just with very brief comments. Listen for what calls one. It really, what calls us is different. I don't at all think we should all do X, Y, or Z. Listen for what calls you, where you want to apply your activity. I think of several people I've worked with who said, "I want to be involved. I want to be more active." I said, "What issue?" I think of one person, she said, "Climate issues." Okay. And I said, "Okay, we'll come back in a week. Research." And before that, I asked her, "How much time do you have? Let's say per week." She said, "I've got 5 hours a week. Research five possibilities for you putting 5 hours a week into helping with climate issues." She came back and she said, "I got it." And she's been doing it ever since. Right? So find what calls you. Can be helpful to ask that question of how many hours I have. And then I'll finish with a quotation from the great activist and theologian Howard Thurman, African American, who set up the first interracial church in the Bay Area, had been a teacher at Howard and Boston University. And he died around 1980, or about 7 or 8 years before that. He talked to a young man who asked him, "What should I do to help the world?" And you may remember his response. He said, "Don't ask what the world needs. Rather, ask what makes you come alive. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." So, thank you. Let's just sit quietly for a moment and see what comes to you, see what resonates. Anything you want to share or ask? So thank you. Let's open things up. Any questions? I was particularly emphasizing the ethical dimension of practice as a foundation, and also foundation for acting in the world, for thinking about things, and also what really propels one. Do I have an ethical commitment? And according to the teachings and the practice, part of our commitment is to practice ethics. It's not an option in our practice, it's part of the practice. Okay. So, any thoughts, questions, sharing of any kind? Yeah, please, Deborah, and then Mary.
I couldn't wait to hear you tonight, Donald, because I knew that you would be talking about these, and you hit all the nails on the head. And I thank you with a lot of gratitude. And I love that you brought up joy because at the demonstration I was at yesterday here in downtown San Rafael with a few of my neighbors, there was a lot of joy. I felt a lot of joy. The creativity, the passion, the comprehensiveness of what people were, the speakers were, we there were speakers, there was a lot of joy. It was very heartening for me. And I got a text today from one of the women who I had driven, and she thanked me for the drive because she said that it was really nourishing for her and heartening for her. So thank you for hitting on that note because I think it's really important because I do have a lot of despair and anger about what's going on in the world today. So that joy is a real. It's a real boost. Thank you for everything you've said. You're a blessing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Deborah. And just so crucial. And again, it's joy is not supposed to substitute for anger or eliminate it. It's rather we open to what's there, but very important to deliberately open to joy. And again, I think we find it in many movements. I also was at a gathering yesterday, actually, with my sister and my cousin, and just the sense of being together, community. A lot of the signs were very humorous and heartfelt. One of them that I remembered was "Stop truth decay." Stop truth decay. Very creative. So, I think so crucial to, I guess, really have joy practice be central in these times right now.
I also really appreciated you bringing up the Kabbalah because at a movie I saw years and years ago that came out of the Jewish Film Festival, when they were talking about the Kabbalah, I knew I was hearing Dharma. It was really interesting. So, really, again, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. And so we have Mary and Liz and Rick.
So, thank you. So, yesterday morning, I just finished doing a week-long online retreat that was pretty intensive on the Four Noble Truths. And one of the things that I really thought about was I was making a sign. And I thought my sign has to be right speech. And then I wanted it to be positive. So I had the No Kings, but then I had the the First Amendment is what I put on the sign. I thought I wanted it to be something positive because I had to feel comfortable with what I was going to be representing. And it is. It was first really difficult because I was just feeling, I was so glad when I went that the energy and everybody who was there was like really okay. And I had told my husband, if it's not, I think I'm going to have to leave. I'm not going to be able to stay. Because at that point, you know how you are after you've been on an intensive retreat. It's like you're just so open to everything. And it was so lovely that I was able to stay there the whole time and be really, really comfortable. And you're right. There is joy and there is positivity. And I think that for me, one of my main practices is mudita.
Yeah, beautiful, Mary. And I think also I like your making a connection between wise speech and the signs that people might carry or the messages that they might have. I was very conscious of that. And the one that I went to, I saw some that, I think they were, I saw a few where people were just venting sort of unprocessed anger. Very, very understandable, and one can be empathic. But I think it's been, but most of them were more positive and hopeful. So I think that's, it's a very interesting, and also to, I need to study some of the, for me, I'm a student of the history of nonviolence and nonviolent movements. And a lot of them have had actually, you look to Dr. King's gatherings and many of the demonstrations, they had very strict guidelines for people participating, right? And obviously no violence, but also, I remember one list from Birmingham, 1963. The last of them really is the equivalent of us saying, let me be there with metta. I think it was there for Dr. King was walk and speak in the matter of love, or Jesus's love, right? Something like that. Yeah, thank you. Liz, please.
Hi there. So I was taking notes and I came up with the words renunciation and needs. Okay.
Renunciation and what was
needs, NEEDS as a nonviolent communication needs.
Renunciation and needs, okay.
All right, so I'm in a group that protests and I have very strong ideas about how we should protest, that we should protest the government. Other people in the group want to protest about climate change and food for Gazans. And I'm very, very tightly wrapped around my need to see just stuff about the government, what the government is doing, how it's inhibiting us. And I get very, very angry. And I've been watching this. And I love the concept of needs, which I've been studying for years.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nonviolent Communication. And I didn't understand until yesterday, until one of the guys wrote me back about my feelings about what he was doing. I saw very clearly that these needs are very strong for him. He really does believe in protesting about climate change. It's very dear to his heart. It's very important to him. As important as my need is not to do that. Now, I have had to grow here, unfortunately. I've had to grow and be open and accept the fact that I'm going to have to share these needs, which are not mine, and respect them. And I fought against this for days. So it's very interesting to watch this in myself and to grow. To renounce my need to be, have my needs be the most important, to be inclusive, to accept that someone has other needs that are just as important to them. And how do I go about that? And it's a very wonderful painful process. So that's all I can say about that.
Well, thank you, Liz, and thanks for really sharing a sometimes challenging process. I appreciate that. And there, I won't go too much into it, but my own sense is that there might be ways that you can actually come together.
Oh, yes.
Not just in terms of including each other, but even on your understanding of what you're doing. Is that?
Yes, I think there is.
Yeah,
And
there are ways.
it's my growth. It's my growth that needs to happen.
To really see where there may be actually more of a connection than you initially thought. Yeah, that's
Yep.
great. Yeah.
So
Thanks.
that's effort. That's for me, that's right effort.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you for your practice. Yay.
Not fun, but wonderful.
Maybe last person before we go to our closing. Rick, please.
Yes, two things. One is went to the demonstrations yesterday in Larkspur Landing at the Ferry Building, and it was very joyous, and 500 to 1,000 people. And all the cars driving by were honking and expressing support, and everybody's going around taking photos of the most clever signs. And the ones they favored were the most positive ones.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
And the people line up to take a picture of one sign or another. And a great joy was had by all. It was a very wonderful experience. My first political campaign was, I was 20 years old. I dropped out of college and went to the civil rights movement. Wound up in Americus, Georgia, staying on a communal farm run by the American Friends Service Committee. And they introduced us to meditation. And they went with us to the demonstrations. And they were the most mellow people at the demonstrations. They were the rock we all relied on to keep our meditation nonviolent, our demonstration nonviolent and peaceful. And we had, I had a crash course in nonviolence and meditation at the same time. Most of it went over my head. We got beat up by the Ku Klux Klan, thrown in jail. But in jail, everybody was very joyous, singing a lot of songs. Not much of a jail. It was more like a stable that we were locked up in. But communally, and we were singing a lot of songs and making a lot of humor, jailhouse humor. And I've been trying to learn from, most of it was way over my head at the time. And I missed a lot that I could have taken advantage of, but I've been trying to learn about nonviolence and politics and meditation ever since. And I thank you very much for today's talk, because it's just right what I've been thinking about, and I really appreciate it. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Rick. Thank you for the story. Yeah, you kind of landed almost unexpectedly into a very special community where you got very high level training. Really remarkable. And thank you also
Yeah,
for.
I missed most of it, but the story was so much. There was a local farmer right next door. It was a peanut farmer. He turned out to be Jimmy Carter,
Well,
and he was friends with all these people. He actually spoke to us. I like I said, I missed most of this, went way over my head. But there are a lot of stories in there. Everybody has a story, and there are a lot of other stories that, very interesting.
yeah, thank you, Rick, and thanks also for naming the dimension of joy both yesterday and then, what must have been 60 years ago.
And thinking about it, Jimmy Carter was probably our most Buddhist-like president.
Yeah, thank you.